I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Kate Braid joins me now. She's just published a new collection of essays, The Erotics of Cutting Grass, Reflections on a Well-Loved Life. It's an engaging, heartfelt, often witty collection that looks at various subjects of interest, parenting, grandparenting, aging, health, travel, wisdom, spirituality, writing, singing, among other fascinating points of entry into her thoughtful life. Ms. Braid, who joined me last week, has previously written about her work in the male-dominated world of construction in her memoirs Journey Woman, Swinging a Hammer in a Man's World, and Nail, Notes of a Journey Woman. She touches on the years she spent in construction, but also looks at how it's affected how she sees herself and how others might view her. She's often candid, frank, and so inviting to the reader to ponder their own thoughts, feelings, and existence. Kate Braid is an award-winning writer and poet. Among her many accolades include the Remarkable Woman of the Arts and Pandora's Collective BC Mentors Awards and the Pat Lowther and Van City Book Prizes. She was writer-in-residence at Mabel Dodge Lewin House in Taos, New Mexico. Visit katebraid.com for more. She joined me from Pender Island, where she'll be launching the book Wednesday, the 30th of April, at 1 p.m. That's at the North Pender Island Library. There are events later this summer. Those are listed on her website. This new book is published by Caitlin Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Kate Braid. Ms. Braid, good morning.
Hi. Nice to be talking to you.
Nice to talk to you. The book, as I was telling you just before we started, feels like I'm talking to somebody that I know, a friend that I'm getting to know, truth be told, I knew very little about you until I started reading the book. When you're writing, do you think about the audience as you write? And is that the sense that you have as you're writing, that you're, are you conversing to a lot of people or one person?
Good question. I write prose, like this book, and I also write poetry. When I'm writing poetry, I'm writing to one person. But I would say when I'm writing prose, I'm writing to more people. And I'm also very aware, it's sort of like doing a reading. I feel like people are very real to me, my audience, and I'm looking at them.
You do something that's delightful in the book is you're narrating the typos. And I wish I wrote down a couple of examples in the book where you use a word. And then you write right after, you'd mistype the word. And you're having this conversation with us about how the typo might have worked, too.
Well, yeah, it's like the essay on erotics, The Erotics of Cutting Grass. I actually, the first time I wrote that, I deleted it because it's so corny, and then put it back.
It's a captivating title, I have to say, and it's probably one of the reasons why I picked the book to do on the show even before I read it. There's so much more than that, obviously. You talk a bit about previous careers, the work in construction in the 1970s and 80s. Was that primarily here in British Columbia?
Yeah, it was totally in British Columbia.
I see. So this is right after you'd arrived from Quebec?
No. I came from Quebec in 1970, and then, long story, I did all the sort of, girl jobs, secretary, receptionist, blah, blah, and I couldn't find a thing I loved. I couldn't find anything, so I decided maybe I should go back to school and get a degree, and that wasn't it either, another degree. So I came to Pender Island just to take a break. And I thought I'd be here for a couple of months and then go back and finish my degree. And I fell in love with Pender Island, which is easy to do. Mm-hmm. And so this is where I ended up getting into construction in 1977. Was my first job here on Pender as a laborer building the new school.
And you narrate in the book just how physically demanding it is, but also you found it quite rewarding. I kept thinking as I was reading that part of the book, going back to what you might have derived from it, I'm sure there are technical aspects of the, in construction, say, that are similar to the process of writing. Are there?
That's a great question. I never thought of that. Technical. Well, no, because for me, at first thought anyway, construction is, yes, it takes brains to be good at it. That's what you learn as an apprentice, is all the, what we call the tricks of the trade, ways to do it faster, easier, with less physical output.
Mm-hmm.
But writing has, the tricks of writing are obviously less physical and much more mental.
The thing that I was comparing it to is because writing is as much rewriting as anything.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why I'm not a writer is because I find that part tedious. I would think that some parts of construction or building something would be tedious.
Yeah, they are. You know, digging ditches is pretty boring.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's why when, as you get better and better, you get, you're given less and less of the boring jobs.
Mm.
Because you're good at those by then, and you get more and more interesting jobs.
There's a piece in the book where you talk about the books you've read and what it evokes, say, for the reader at the time and later. Because you do remember things like where you read such and such a book and what you were feeling and the sort. And it's a wonderful exploration of how these books stay with you. You talk about this one book, Green Mansions, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
And how that changed for you. And that's something that I think a lot of us overlook in terms of our relationships with, say, art. Because these things change. We'd like to think, you know, something was our favorite all the time because, you know, it reflects, you know, say, our good taste or our maturity. But some of these things, you know, it's sort of like food that we shouldn't eat too much of that... sometimes they're not good for us, are they?
Well, it's more, I try and sort of block out the ones that aren't good for us.
Mm.
And as I say in that essay, I remember the things that were good. I mean, that book, Green Mansions, which I read when I was about 14, changed my life. And then I also talk in the essay about how when I went back to it as an adult who was, you know, by then... had been a carpenter and now a writer, and I had got the book all wrong. I had thought that Rima, the heroine, was the heroine, and she was this wonderful woman who lived in the jungles down in South America, completely free, including, you know, weaving her dresses out of cobwebs and so on. And this, I was reading this in the 60s, 50s, oh my goodness, when the only options open to me were to get married and have children as a girl. And if I was really, really pushing things, I could work for a few years before I got married and have children. And I could be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher. But I wanted what Rima had.
Yeah.
I wanted to be free and wild and see what happened. So that actually misconception of Rima stayed with me and really supported me for much of my life until I met a few other female role models like Wonder Woman and
yeah.
Emily Carr. And because for a very long time, I never met another woman doing any kind of trades work, and it was so I was feeling sort of like a freak.
That's a fascinating way to think about it, is that we do get out of art, books, all the things that we love, what we need out of them. And even if it's not, we later find out that it's not quite what it should be or what it is, we do take what we need out of it, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess, at least in my case, I created what I needed.
Yeah.
I was an avid reader, even, you know, from the beginning.
That's like the first time I saw Death of a Salesman. I was 10 years old. It was on TV one night. It's the Dustin Hoffman version.
Oh, yeah.
And I was quite moved by it, even at 10. And then I find out he dies, and then you know, I'm surprised that he dies. But then I forgot, you know, that was the title of the whole thing, right? So, you know.
Yep, and but it still affected you, because you needed that right
now. Yeah, and then it's still, you know, I still think of that, and just how moved I was, and I've seen it since, and it doesn't hit as much as it does, but you know, every time I watch a different version of it, say on TV, there's something I find out that I didn't know before, you know?
So do you still find that an inspiration in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you wish you could write things like that, or you wish you could act like Lee J. Cobb in that version of it. You find yourself quoting them at inappropriate times at conversation and the sort. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. But it stays with you. I mean, you know, and it's just a wonderful thing that we can find in art exactly mm-hmm. what we need and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. how it stays. I mean, I could watch it, something just as good today, but I won't remember it 10
maybe
years hence.
Maybe it's also at a certain, it strikes you at a certain time.
Yeah.
Like, when you're 10 years old or I was 14, we needed something. And it was later, I mean, another of the essays in the book is about my learning to play the cello.
Yeah.
And that came again at a time in my life when I really needed something beautiful because some rough stuff was happening.
Yeah.
And, so it stuck with me, the images I had seen of Pablo Casals of Rostropovich and those guys, and I thought, okay, that's what I need, cello.
Yeah, that's what's inspiring about the book is that when you talk about, say, playing the cello, learning to play the cello, singing in public, as a solo performer, studying Buddhism. You're honest about how these things, trigger an interest, but how you also, you know, you take your time. You don't immediately get into this thing that you want to, say, start, and how it doesn't, how it's not easy at times. And I guess that's the message for a lot of people listening to this, is that what you think is scary is something that you should try, something you should think about, really. Mm-hmm. And try, mm-hmm. Because there's a great reward, there's a great payoff,
mm-hmm.
and you've done that over the years, even at, say, when you're older, and some people might think, well, you shouldn't really do that at that age. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I did my first solo gig when I was 77.
Yeah,
crazy.
Yeah. Did you find that? I mean, for a lot of people, they wouldn't think of doing something like singing in public, doing a solo in public at any age.
Well, to tell you the truth, Joe, I didn't either. I got talked into it by various people. I mean, I've always sung. I mm-hmm. love choirs. I love being in choirs. I love being an alto and feeling the harmony, like my body vibrates in a choir singing harmony, but my husband plays guitar, and his little group that he plays in desperately needed a soloist recently, and the teacher for their little group knew that I had taken voice lessons, you know, like in the choir, I wanted to have a better voice, and he asked me, and he did call me, and I said, I don't think I have never wanted to do solo, ever. I actually tried it once at a music camp, and I was utterly terrified, which is funny, because as a writer, I do oral reading.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I said, no, absolutely not. And he talked me into it, and I said, I'll only do it if you do a test. I'll come, and you listen to me sing, and if it's too awful, I will not be offended. Anyway, no, he said, yes, come. So I did it. I sang not only four songs all by myself on the stage with a bunch of wonderful musicians.
Yeah.
But I ended it. The last song, which one of the musicians really wanted to play, was what's the name of that song about loving, hold me tight, famous song, and it's just gone in my head.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a pretty sexy song. Ella Fitzgerald sang it, and I thought, well, I've gone this far. I've got to stop now. So here I was, 77 years old, singing this sexy love song. And I thought, okay, that was good, but end. So I sang it and then left the stage, and that was the end of my singing career.
But there was a moment where you thought you'd like to do it again, and then someone reminded you that it took you away from your writing, which you hated.
Exactly, yeah.
But there is a lesson that you're able to, say, derive even from an experience that's less than fun. I guess there's a lesson there for people listening to us that you give it a shot, right?
Yeah, try it. Yep.
Yeah.
My test is always, what does my gut say, not my brain or not what other people say. What does my gut say? And if my gut is curious, even though I think it's insane, I think, well, try it. And, you know, like for the singing thing, I realized, oh, you know, I know what I could have done to make it better. And it was, yeah, my sister said to me, are you insane? This is your writing time. So I said, no, I'm not doing that. It's not what I want to commit myself to. I'm committed to writing. I love writing. So, but I got the impetus from that gut feeling that I love music, I love singing.
And you got an essay out of it, which is a beautiful essay. Because nobody dies of shame or you know, well, getting scared. Well, so some people might, but not that kind of scared, if you know what
no.
I mean. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah. So somebody could creep up and yell boo, and that could probably kill me. But this won't kill me, you know what I mean? The essay on hearing loss I found just instructive because a lot of people are contending with issues as they get older, things that they don't expect or they don't realize are part of getting older.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, it can be a struggle to cope. You've managed to find a way to I mean, it wasn't easy.
No.
There are a lot of tears and a lot of frustrating experiences with people in the medical field, as you narrate. What do you tell people about, say, a certain loss and how to contend with it? I mean, there's some wisdom that you've obviously derived from your own experience.
Well, thank you for giving me credit. But all I do now, for example, a friend of mine recently said, you know, I woke up this morning and I couldn't hear out of one ear very well. And I instantly clicked into, you know, helper mode, because that's how my deafness started, was I woke up and it was very hot. It was like my ear was full of water. I couldn't hear my... And it's the story is in the book, but what I learned from it, shortcut, is if you wake up one morning and you can't hear out of one ear, go as fast as you can get there to an audiologist, an ear, nose, throat doctor, if you can get to one, and get it checked, because it's called sudden sensory neural deafness. And they don't, as of yet, it might have improved, but when I was doing it, they had no cure, they didn't know what caused it, they'd give you a bunch of prednisone, maybe that would help, but not usually. It's a tricky thing, but apparently over and over, ear, nose, throat doctors told me time is of the essence. So that's what I tell people.
Mm-hmm.
And then... In the essay, I also talk about how I learned to deal with deafness, how I learned to live with deafness.
It reminded me of people that I've known growing up, older people who, I guess I sort of picked up that like a lot of our senses, they tend to dull as we get older.
Yeah.
I had an infection in my ear one time about 5 years ago, and... it was not a comfortable It was in one ear, and it was just annoying more than anything. And as I was reading the essay, I kept thinking about what I did then, and because sometimes, you know, you do feel it as a problem.
Yeah.
I haven't had hearing loss, but it's still annoying. You know, it's still there, and mm-hmm. You sort of think about what you would do in a similar situation.
Well, and you know what, Joe? I would say the same thing. Go to an audiologist, get your hearing tested. What I've noticed, since I now pay more attention to that kind of thing, is a lot of people who have minor hearing loss don't realize what they're missing.
Yeah.
So things happen, conversations or audio things, that they don't even know. For example, the fine-tuning in music or some of that kind of stuff. And I think it's worth going and getting your hearing tested. And if they suggest hearing aids, they will show you what it would be like with or without the hearing aid, and you can make up your mind. But the other thing, just to put a bit of the fear of death into everybody, is that as your hearing goes, your brain is less stimulated.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, as we all age and the brain sort of slips away anyway, you want to do everything you can to keep things running.
Yeah, I was thinking of my vision because, you know, as one gets older, you notice that things are harder to read.
Yep.
And the sort. And I noticed with the television set that it was getting dimmer. And so I wondered what that was, and sure enough, it hit the wrong button. But you know, you do, you're fearful for a moment everything is getting dimmer, you know, and it's one of those things you don't notice until you know.
Mm-hmm. Until you do.
Yeah, I was in Nanaimo recently, a city that I don't know anything about, and. Because in Vancouver, I've lived here my whole life, and so, you know, you get around, you don't even look at the signs, right? But in Nanaimo, when you're there, and you have to get somewhere, you have to look at the signs.
Yeah, you have to read.
Yeah, and so, you know, you notice how even the big print is not as big as it should be. Then, you realize, where are my glasses, right?
Exactly.
I was telling you something off tape that I won't mention here because it's tedious. We have a birthday in the same month.
Yeah.
And you write so gracefully about getting older.
Hmm.
And, again, it's one of those things that I was reading over the last couple of weeks when I had a birthday that I'd been thinking about. And because somebody asked me at dinner this past weekend what I did on my birthday. As if, you know, I was going to mark it with some big thing, you know, like doing something or being with family or friends or something. And I didn't do anything because, you know, to me it's not a big deal anymore. I mean, it might have been a big deal when I was a kid, say before I was 18.
Yep.
But as I get older, it's just, you know, another day, right? Mm-hmm. Well, how do you feel about that? Like, I know some people that take the day off work or the week off work and things like that. I mean, how do you mark birthdays now?
Well, I just had my 78th birthday,
mm-hmm.
Which bears thinking about. I must say, the big turning point for me was 50, when I suddenly thought, oh, my God, I'm getting old. And it's been more and more sinking in since then, so I've thought about it a lot. And the good thing about being a writer is you can always write about it.
Yeah.
But, so I thought about, I mean, some things are definitely a drag, like your body. You've talked about, you know, our ears, our eyes, our energy. There are some things you can do, like glasses and hearing aids and, you know, good diet. So you do what you can do, but it's inevitable, and I think it was the William Saroyan, was he American?
Yeah, I think he was American because he was married to. For some reason, when I saw that when I saw Saroyan in the book, I there's a connection to Walter Matthau. Like his wife was his daughter or something like that, or something. So I just assumed that he's American anyway.
Yeah. I think anyway, he said on his deathbed, he said, "I know everybody has to die, but somehow I thought an exception would be made in my case."
Yeah.
And I thought, yep, we probably all have gone through that stage too. But so the thing I think about now is I make the best of it. And so, yes, I like to honor the day. I do think it's important. It's another turning point. But I also have come to think there are definitely some advantages to being older. I mean, given that I had no choice, right?
Yeah. That's what I found inspiring about when you talk about getting older, is that there's a lot that's good. There's obviously a lot that's bad, but there's some things that are easier too.
Yeah.
And you see the world differently as you get older, and
it's a longer perspective.
Yeah, and I kind of wish I had that when I was younger.
Well, you could talk to your young friends or your kids, and but I don't think they'd get it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the strength of getting older is, and I talk a bit about that, we know what we know, and we also know that young people who are like gung-ho, and, I have a 17-year-old granddaughter, that you telling them it's not going to be exactly like you think isn't going to make any difference at all. It might discourage them, so let them at it. Boy, we need that energy in the world. Yes. So, it's the looking back, I find, is one of the big strengths of being older, and you can't get it when you're 17.
Yeah. Is there something, though, Kate, that you know now that you wish you knew earlier?
Ooh, trick question.
I mean, other than the lottery numbers, maybe, or something like that, right?
I wish I had more confidence in myself.
Mm.
And I don't know how much that has to do with being a woman. I don't know. You might know a bit about that as a man of color. I see the confidence. I mean, it is also a racist, sexist thing. White men, and I know because I worked for 15 years very closely with them all day long, they have a kind of confidence that can only come, I can think, from being white men. Because a lot of the guys, these are working class guys.
They weren't
geniuses in any much, in, at least they were in construction, but that wasn't very respected in our culture. So, yeah, I wish I'd had more confidence.
I'm laughing because it reminded me, I was in a situation one time with some people. I felt like I was surrounded by a lot of obnoxious people.
Mm.
So I texted a friend of mine and I said, I wish I had the confidence of a mediocre white guy. And because they seem to get around a lot easier.
Yes, they do.
Than, than somebody like myself who,
yep.
is not. Yep. And
I must say, I do think this is starting to change. Like, I have a son who's a white guy, and he's not one of those, super confident, even arrogant kind of, I'm a white guy, get out of my way guys.
Yeah.
So, and young men in construction, I can see some of them, they're changing, they're a bit more sensitive, more aware, less arrogant.
Yeah, I guess that's the folly, though, that I think people like myself who look like me might think that we have to go bad, if you will, or do something rude, to get attention or to get along with life. And and I see that in some friends of mine sometimes, I find that disheartening. And but I guess as you get older, it's easier to, because we lose friends a lot over the, through just attrition, right? It's a good excuse, to get rid of people that are not healthy for us.
Yes. And I also think, this is one of the good things about getting older, is I don't care anymore what people think.
Yeah.
And I used to care deeply, especially as a woman. I used to care deeply. And now it's like, well, if you don't like it, it's your problem. It's not mine.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing for me as I got older, was to I don't know if that was after 20 or after 30, where I just didn't give a shit anymore what people thought about me.
Yeah.
I still did care, and I still do care. Like, if someone said that I stole something and I didn't, I would take great umbrage with that and try to, you know, clear my name, if you will. But if they said they didn't like me, well, you know, that really doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, no. Or they don't like the clothes you're wearing.
Yeah, to hell with them, yeah.
Yeah.
You write, Kate, of the delights of writing in splendid isolation. It's a wonderful line. Yeah. What is it like for you to because you do talk about having to get out and, say, talk to groups about your writing.
Yeah.
And the struggle with that. Once a work is published, like this collection, and you have to talk about it. Either there's certain dates that are coming up in the next few weeks where you're talking publicly, you're talking about it now on here with me. Do you find the performative aspects of, say, talking about the work, do you find that still difficult?
Well, it's two parts. Yes, it isn't. I get nervous. It isn't entirely easy. But, like, and I say this, it's also, I really value the physical feedback. I seem to be a physical person. So when I'm reading to an audience, or here even talking to you, I really value, it's very, you know, that sort of body language that you pick up. Someone says, or there's a little giggle, or, so you get some really valuable feedback, especially for poetry that's not published, or for anything that's not published. Sometimes just hearing it out loud, I edit it as I go. So it's being vulnerable is the hard part of reading my work. The most vulnerable I ever was with a book, and up until then I would have said, no, the hardest to read is poetry because you're so open. But the first memoir I wrote about being a carpenter was called Journey Woman, Swinging a Hammer in a Man's World. And that was the utter truth from my heart and soul, which I didn't even write for myself eventually. It took me 25 years to figure that out. I wrote it for other women because no one had written a book about day-to-day, what is it like to be a woman carpenter always working with men? Unless once I started my own company and I could hire women. But mostly, most of my working life as a construction worker was with men. And women need to know that, because there are some... And then I wrote a second memoir to follow up, Hammer and Nail, about tricks of how to do it. And I thought, you know what? Young men going into the trade can use this too, not just women. The day I launched that book, my publisher had a big hall. There were lots of people, lots of my friends from construction, women in trades. I was so nervous, I could hardly sign my name. My hand was shaking because I felt so vulnerable. It was such an honest book.
Yeah.
But I did it, and people liked it, and they bought it, and they still buy it. So what I realized is that's the trick of good writing, is being that honest. And it's hard because you're laying yourself open.
Yeah. And you do lay yourself open in this collection in a number of moments. And it's such a gift for us to hear because, I mean, you know, a lot of us might have sort of similar anxieties or fears.
Uh-huh.
And we may have thought until we read the book that it was just us.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Great compliment.
Do you write every day?
I try. It's now coming summer, and we're living on 5 acres, and there's a lot to do, although I'm very lucky. My partner loves working outdoors, so mostly my job is cutting the grass, hence the essay.
Yeah.
But I try and write every day. I go through spasms. Sometimes I'll write prose every day. Sometimes I'll write poetry. Sometimes I'll just edit. But, yeah.
So do you have a certain amount of hours that you work, say, on the writing itself?
No, I'm not nearly that organized, Joe.
Yeah. That's the thing that I was, because I talk to people all the time, and they say, you know, they only do it in the early morning hours, which I could, I'm not awake yet, you know, and I could never comprehend that sort of lifestyle and staring at something that you've written for a while and trying to figure it out.
Yeah. I must say, and I suspect all of us are different in this, but I have figured out over the years that for me the best writing time when I'm freshest and have the most brain power is in the morning, so not early. But if I get into my office by 9, I'm doing well, and if I can write till 12 or even 1 or, you know, edit or whatever I'm doing, that's a good day. And usually the afternoons I'm sort of sluggish and I take the dog for a walk or whatever.
Do you understand how people are able to, say, write in a busy place like a coffee shop or something like that?
No, I'm not one of those people, but lots of people do it.
Yeah, you talk in the book about going to the public library here in Vancouver and spending a lot of time. But like I said, it's a library, so it's a lot quieter, right?
Yeah, very quiet. Yeah. And I went into a part of the library where there weren't many people.
Yeah.
No, I like the feeling of, I know this is stupid and self-conscious, but I always feel like in coffee shops I'm being watched.
Hmm.
I'm certain that's not true, and I just contradict myself because I said I don't care anymore what people think, but I still like the sense of being alone when I write. And the library was really good for that because I needed that discipline, and that's how I got it to finish that book, the Journey Woman book.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time. And just how much I enjoyed being with the collection the last couple of weeks or so. Congratulations on it and continued good luck with it. Thanks for this.
Well, thank you so much. Pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
The website for more is at katebraid.com. The book is called The Erotics of Cutting Grass, Reflections on a Well-Loved Life. It's published by Caitlin Press. Its author, Kate Braid, joined me on the line from Pender Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.